the private equity billionaire, J.P. Morgan Vice Chair James Lee, and John Thane of Merrill Lynch, to hold McCain in line. But this left McCain tongue-tied, torn between the demands of the system and the populist groundswell that Palin was rallying to his cause. In the climactic meeting of the two candidates with the Bush administration on September 25th, a meeting called at McCain's request, the Republican candidate literally had nothing to say. By Sunday, September 28th, it seemed that Paulson and the congressional Democrats had a deal. Paulson agreed to caps on remuneration, a phased release of the TARP aid, multiple layers of oversight, and a commitment that if the taxpayer made a loss, the cost would be covered by a tax on the financial industry. To speed TARP along, it was tacked onto House Resolution 3997, also known as the Defenders of Freedom Tax Relief Act, providing tax breaks for members of the armed services, volunteer firefighters, and Peace Corps members. On the morning of the vote, Monday, September 29th, the president gave a press conference hailing agreement on the Paulson bill. Later that same day, he was hosting embattled President Yushchenko of Ukraine. It was a moment to demonstrate that the leader of the free world was still firmly in charge. Markets needed all the help they could get. The news from Europe was terrible. On Wall Street, trading was jittery. All eyes were on the screens, waiting for the news from Capitol Hill. The scene in the House of Representatives was not reassuring. After a morning of polemical speeches, voting started after lunchtime. On screens around the world, one could see the grinding process of congressional democracy in action. At 1:49 p.m., at the end of the normal voting period, the votes stood 228 to 205 against. The party leadership on both sides were staring into the abyss. To give the whips a chance to rally their troops, the voting period was extended, and the TV cameras followed, as top lieutenants in both parties clutching lists of votes clustered in the well and made unusual forays into what is normally enemy territory across the aisle. 5 minutes later, it was clear that they had come up short. The gavel came down minutes before 2 p.m., and the bill failed. Tellingly, of the 205 votes in favor of Hank Paulson's TARP plan, 140 came from the Democrats and only 65 from the Republicans. Of those opposed, 133 were Republicans and 95 Democrats. After the Fed and the Treasury had allowed Lehman to fail, America's elected representatives had refused to back their own government's emergency rescue effort. The reaction in the markets was one of terror. The Dow Jones Index plummeted by 778 points, wiping $1.2 trillion off the value of American businesses in a matter of hours. It was the biggest loss on record, worse than on 9/11, when the index had plunged by 684 points. The shock to global confidence was devastating. It produced a terrifying synchronization of the crisis on both sides of the Atlantic. As the Americans were trying and failing to patch together the first TARP deal, in London, Gordon Brown's government was frantically trying to persuade Spain's Santander to buy out the branch network of mortgage lender Bradford & Bingley and its £22 billion in deposits. That would leave the UK Treasury holding £41 billion in mortgages that no one wanted to touch. When the UK had bailed out Northern Rock a year earlier, it had still seemed as though it might be an isolated incident. Now it was clear that the entire British financial system was at stake. It was lethally dependent on the wholesale funding market, and that was shutting down. The fear was that panic would soon spread from specialised mortgage lenders like Northern Rock to bigger banks like HBOS, and from there to the commercial bank RBS, whose balance sheet, on paper at least, had recently ranked as the largest of any bank in the world. On the continent, the Belgian, Dutch, Luxembourgeois giant Fortis was on the point of being shut down. Its balance sheet matched that of Lehman. The French government was struggling to keep the Franco-Belgian lender Dexia alive. Angela Merkel and her finance minister Pierre Steinbrück were in knife-edge negotiations over Hypo Real Estate, which was being dragged down with DEPFA, its adventurous Dublin affiliate. Each rescue involved a combination of writing down losses, recapitalizing with public money, guaranteeing private borrowing, deal-making with other banks, and emergency liquidity from the central bank. The Europeans were putting out one fire after another, bank by bank. But on the night of September 29th, with the failure of TARP roiling the markets, Dublin cracked. The three main Irish banks, Anglo-Irish Bank, Bank of Ireland, and Allied Irish Bank, were all on the brink of collapse. The balance sheets of the banks, registered in Ireland, came to 700% of the country's GDP. The Irish state did not have the financial resources to handle a general bank run. After a panic-stricken night of discussion, early in the morning of September 30th, the Dublin government announced that for fear of dying, it would commit suicide. As Europe turned on the morning news, it learned that the Irish government was fully guaranteeing not just the deposits, but all the liabilities of six major Irish banks for a period of 2 years. No other government had been advised in advance, nor had the ECB, nor had the Irish taxpayers. It stopped the run, but it left Ireland, with a population half the size of New York City, guaranteeing 440 billion euros in bank liabilities. The losses the banks incurred would bankrupt the Irish state. They would become the telltale link connecting the banking crisis of 2008 to the Eurozone sovereign debt crises of 2010. But that was music of the future. The issue on September 30th was the immediate impact on the rest of the world. If Ireland was offering a safe haven, would the run now extend to the rest of Europe? Given how tightly the Irish banks were integrated with the British financial system, it was in London that the pressure was most acute. The UK was forced immediately to raise its deposit insurance limit. London and Paris were conferring urgently, as were the Dutch. The Germans were less cooperative. When the UK Treasury tried to reach Berlin to discuss a common European response, they could not get the German finance minister, Steinbrück, to pick up the phone. So anxious did Chancellor Darling become that he resorted to calling on the Foreign Office to find out whether the British Embassy in Berlin could make contact with the German government. And Berlin was not merely evasive. In the last days of September, the Dutch government, reeling from the experience of bailing out Fortis, made a bold proposal. The European states should all establish bank rescue funds on a common basis, each amounting to 3% of GDP. In total, the fund would come to 300 billion euros. The French government was enthusiastic. To address the crisis, Sarkozy invited the G4, France, Germany, Italy, and the UK, to Paris. Ahead of the meeting, French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde spoke to the German business daily Handelsblatt about the need for joint measures. After the fraught transnational negotiations to rescue Dexia and Fortis, she was seriously concerned about the ability of small countries to cope with the crisis. What would happen if a little European Union state confronted a bank collapse? She asked rhetorically. Maybe the government would not have the means to save the institution in question. So the question arises of a solution at the European level. The Italians liked the idea. So too did the influential head of Deutsche Bank, Josef Ackermann. Europe needed something on the scale that Paulson was asking for in the United States. Suddenly, Berlin sprang to life. There must be no talk of joint bailouts, Steinbrück announced. Merkel let it be known that she would not attend the summit in Paris if it was labelled a crisis meeting. As if to bind herself, the Chancellor gave an interview to the popular tabloid Bild Zeitung, soon to become notorious for its nationalist coverage of the crisis, denouncing any blank check for bankers. And Berlin could count on support from Frankfurt. Jean-Claude Trichet of the ECB told journalists that a common European solution was inappropriate because the Eurozone wasn't a fiscal union. Likewise, Jean-Claude Juncker, Prime Minister of Luxembourg and long-serving chair of the Eurogroup, told German radio, "I see no reason why we should mount a US-style program in Europe." The crisis came from the United States. It was deeper there. Europe could get by with national solutions. Sarkozy retreated, saving face by dismissing the idea as an unauthorized personal initiative on Lagarde's part. But the French and the Dutch were right. Within 12 months, precisely the scenario that Lagarde had sketched for Handelsblatt would come to haunt the eurozone. Crippled banks and ailing government borrowers would pull one another down. But prescient though the French might have been, nothing could be done without Berlin. On October 4th, Sarkozy, Merkel, Brown and Berlusconi convened in Paris. The result was disappointing. Gordon Brown came away impressed by the sense that the Europeans thought the crisis to be an American problem. As one disillusioned British official remarked, the Europeans didn't see it coming. They didn't understand the economics. They didn't understand how collective action could work. Sarkozy commented resignedly, "If we cannot cobble together a European solution, then it will be a debacle. But it will not be my debacle. It will be Angela's. You know what she said to me? Chacun sa merde. To each his own shit." According to the German side, the Chancellor's language had been less vulgar. Merkel had quoted a proverb taken from Johann Wolfgang Goethe. "Ein jeder Kehrer vor seine Tour, und rein ist jedes Stadtquartier." Everyone should sweep in front of his door, and every city quarter will be clean. Why were the Germans so resistant? After all, Germany had its fair share of ailing banks that might have benefited from a common fund. But the hard truth was that German taxpayers did not want to pay for other people's bailouts, inside Germany or out. In a broader sense, the question of national versus federal solutions was for Merkel not just a matter of euros and cents. Since 2005, she had been toiling amid the wreckage of Europe's failed effort to give itself a constitution. The Lisbon Treaty, enshrining the grand retreat to a nation-state-based vision of the EU, had been signed only in December 2007. In June 2008, it had suffered a serious setback when it was rejected by a referendum in Ireland. As the financial crisis hit, the Lisbon framework was undergoing emergency surgery. A case in the German Constitutional Court was pending. With the basic political frame of the EU in flux, Berlin was not going to support a huge increase in the powers of the European Commission to enable a bank bailout. Whatever solution was found would be based on intergovernmental agreement, not enhanced federal powers. The most that the summit on October 4th could agree on was a statement calling for coordinated action, rebuking Ireland for its unilateral action the previous week. All the more shocking was what happened next. As the European heads of government made their way home from Paris, the news broke that the rescue of Hypo Real Estate had broken down. Depfer's condition was worse than had been realized. An expert team dispatched by Deutsche Bank to Dublin had found that Hypo would need to come up not with 35 billion, but with 50 billion euros to fill the gap at Depfer. The banks that Merkel and Steinbrück had enlisted in the bailout to support Hypo immediately reneged. As one German banker later put it to the investigative inquiry of the Bundestag, if Lehman's failure had been a tsunami, then the bankruptcy of Hypo Real Estate would have been Armageddon for the German economy. Axel Weber, the head of the Bundesbank, spoke of a nuclear meltdown, Kernschmerze. Somewhat melodramatically, Germany's bank regulator, Jochen Sanyo, invoked apocalypse now. What really worried Berlin were rumours that German savers were panicking. As cash withdrawals spiked, the Bundesbank registered unprecedented demand for large denomination euro notes. Abruptly, less than 24 hours after returning from Paris, Merkel decided that she must make a statement. It was all Steinbrück could do to persuade her that she should not do it entirely alone. On the afternoon of Sunday, October 5th, Merkel and Steinbrück went before the TV cameras. They didn't have a legislative mandate from the Bundestag. They were deliberately vague about the details. But the leaders of the two political parties that had ruled Germany since 1949 jointly declared that all savings deposits were safe. This was directed at a German audience, but it had far wider implications. Germany was not Ireland. Even on the most restrictive definition, Merkel and Steinbrück had given a guarantee in the order of at least €1 trillion. Was Germany positioning itself to take advantage of a global bank run? Berlin gave neither London nor Washington prior warning. Within hours of the Merkel-Steinbrück performance, Prime Minister Brown convened an emergency meeting in Downing Street to consider London's response. British officials tried frantically to reach the Germans, but once again Berlin wasn't answering the phone. In the absence of a clear European policy, smaller countries with big banks, such as Denmark, were forced to make unilateral decisions and to extend guarantees of their own. In Washington, Paulson's team was also scrambling to establish what Merkel had in mind. Was it a moral guarantee, or the kind of binding two-year obligation that Ireland had entered into? It felt as though the US authorities were losing their grip on the situation. "This is going to move quick and force us to do some things we may or may not want to do," Paulson told his staff. If Germany felt it necessary to issue a guarantee, where was America's guarantee? On Monday, October 6th, equity markets shed $2 trillion in value. With the finance ministers of the world converging on Washington for the autumn meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, the Americans decided to call an impromptu gathering of the G7 and G20 finance ministers at the US Treasury for October 10th and 11th. It was reassuring that the Treasury had realized the need for coordination. But a week was a very long time in a financial crisis, and London could not wait. Gordon Brown's government was facing the collapse of two giant banks, HBOS and RBS. Lloyds had agreed to buy out HBOS already on September 18th, but the ailing mortgage lender was losing access to wholesale funding markets. Its credit rating was dropping, and as panic spread, retail and corporate customers withdrew £30 billion. If it failed before the takeover was complete, it would be a catastrophe to dwarf Northern Rock. Given its sheer size, RBS was even more dangerous. Since September 26th, separate teams at the UK Treasury and Downing Street had been working on a bailout plan. To coordinate the crisis fighting, on October 3rd, Brown declared the establishment of a National Economic Council, NEC. The Daily Telegraph immediately dubbed it an economic war cabinet, an idea encouraged by the fact that it met in the underground, high-security conference room usually reserved for the government's Cobra Emergency Response Committee. Despite the uncomfortable and ominous surroundings, the meetings were productive. Whereas Paulson's TARP model was based on the idea of buying bad assets, London brought together two ideas: guarantees and recapitalization. Like Ireland and Germany, London would offer guarantees. The Bank of England and the Treasury would underwrite debt issuance by the banks, but these guarantees would be conditional on recapitalization either through market investment or from public funds. The details were worked out in frantic meetings in Whitehall and road-tested with focus groups of investment bankers who were sworn to secrecy. On the morning of October 7th, while Chancellor Darling was in conference with Europe's finance ministers trying to hammer out an agreed policy on deposit insurance, the share price of RBS collapsed and trading had to be suspended. The bank, that had been touted as the largest in the world as recently as the spring of 2008, was hours away from failure. The UK bank bailout package, launched on October 8, 2008, after a night of cliff-edge negotiation with the leading banks, was an accomplished piece of political theatre. Compared with Paulson's struggles with Congress, Brown and Darling had the huge advantage of a solid majority in the House of Commons. Though Brown's position at the head of the Labour Party was far from secure, he did not have to fear the parliamentary mutiny faced by President Bush. Altogether, the commitments by the UK Treasury and the Bank of England matched or even exceeded those of TARP. Relative to the much smaller UK economy, they were far larger. The British scheme consisted of three parts. 1. The UK's eight major banks were required to draw up plans for recapitalisation. It was left up to them to decide whether they drew on a government fund of £50 billion, that is around $75 to $85 billion, or raised resources privately. 2. £250 billion, $374 to $420 billion, would be used to guarantee new debt issued by participating banks. 3. A £200 billion, $300 to $350 billion extension of the Bank of England's Special Liquidity Scheme would allow banks to trade unsaleable asset-backed securities for treasuries. The issue that had kept bankers and treasury officials up all night was whether the £50 billion recapitalisation should be forced through at a stroke, or whether this might spook the markets. Would it be better to proceed in stages? Perversely, the ailing banks resisted to the bitter end. None of them wanted to become a ward of the state. On the brink of failure, they were still angling for whatever margin of advantage they could extract. In the end, £15 billion in government funds were put into RBS, a 57.9% stake, and £13 billion into Lloyds TSB HBOS, a 43.4% stake. Barclays and HSBC, Britain's strongest banks, ostentatiously opted out of the schemes. They took neither the capital nor the guarantees. The UK government never mustered the authority or even made the attempt to impose recapitalisation on either of them. HSBC, with its large base in Asia, was strong enough to raise funds through the markets. Barclays resorted to a highly irregular deal with a Gulf sovereign wealth fund, to which it lent the funds to recapitalise itself, a transaction for which it was later to pay a substantial fine, and for which its senior management would face criminal charges. Against the backdrop of the TARP debacle and the shambles in Europe, Gordon Brown's scheme looked like a breakthrough. From New York, Paul Krugman lavished praise on Britain's Labour government. Britain's social democrats had figured out how to rescue financial capitalism. It certainly helped that the Labour government was less averse to nationalisation than Hank Paulson was. Less charitably, it might be said that since the 1990s, New Labour, like the Democrats in the United States, had entered into an enthusiastic partnership with the City of London. It was therefore no coincidence that it was now Labour in Britain and the Democrats in the United States who were showing such energy in the struggle to fix the banking crisis. It was a monster they had helped to create. In any case, given the enormous burden that UK taxpayers were going to have to bear in supporting HBOS and RBS, it was hard to see that there was ever any alternative to nationalisation. The reaction of investors was not so enthusiastic as that of the pundits. When the G7 finance ministers assembled on Friday, October 10th, global markets were in a state of panic. That afternoon, in the famous wood-panelled cash room of the US Treasury, the mood was less than amicable. Italy's finance minister, Giulio Tremonti, and Shoichi Nakagawa for Japan, hammered home the damage that had been done by the US decision to let Lehman fail. Steinbrück repeated his line about the end of Anglo-American capitalism. Jean-Claude Trichet indulged in a little theatrics by handing around a single graph showing the surge in the LIBOR-OIS spread since the Lehman failure. It was a benchmark of the funding pressure the European banks were under. The Americans, seconded by Mervyn King of the Bank of England, held their cool and insisted that though Lehman might be the proximate cause, it was hardly the fundamental source of all the world's problems. To turn the discussion in a more positive direction, they proposed a short, 5-point plan. 1. There would be no more failures of systematically important institutions. 2. There would be measures to assist recapitalisation. 3. They would work to unfreeze liquidity in interbank markets. 4. They would provide adequate deposit insurance. 5. They would rebuild markets for securitised assets. As a surprise treat for the finance ministers, President Bush made an impromptu appearance to add some easy charm to the discussions. Unfortunately, Bush's remarks were not well calculated to reassure his guests. "You folks don't need to worry," he told them. "Hank's got a handle on this. He's going to freeze that liquidity." Given that TARP was still in limbo, and that freezing liquidity was the last thing anyone needed, it can hardly have been comforting. Back in Europe, 3 days later, the agreements in Washington set the tone for a meeting of the Eurozone heads of government in Paris. Sarkozy was the host, but the lead part belonged to Gordon Brown. Though the UK was not a Eurozone member, the City of London was the financial capital of Europe, and the British bank bailout plan was now being touted as the model. Politically, Sarkozy hoped to use Brown's weight to push the Germans into a more cooperative attitude. Though what emerged from the meeting on October 12th was a huge headline figure for bank guarantees, it was less than a European plan. There was no agreement on a common European response. The European Commission issued a permissive license to member states to issue debt guarantees as long as they were extended to all banks in the country, both domestic and foreign. There must be no discrimination. For the duration of the crisis, European states were free to pump capital into the banks. The EU would act as an agency of oversight and try to minimize the extent to which the European common market would be torn apart. But it was not a crisis fighter in its own right. In total, the Commission would review and approve 20 schemes for bank debt guarantee and 15 for recapitalizations. On top of that came applications for support for individual banks, 44 from Germany alone. But it was case by case, country by country. Merkel's veto was decisive. It would be 3 long years before a common European bailout was back on the agenda. On Monday, October 13th, 2008, the UK nationalised Lloyds HBOS and RBS. That same day, Germany announced that it was putting up €400 billion in guarantees and €100 billion for recapitalisation. France guaranteed €320 billion in medium-term bank debt and set up a €40 billion capitalisation fund. Italy budgeted €40 billion for capitalisation and, as much as necessary, in guarantees. In the Netherlands, the guarantees came to €200 billion. Spain and Austria each put up €100 billion. In proportion to GDP, the largest programme was that in Ireland. But Belgium and the Netherlands also made huge commitments. Europe's national programmes were defined by the circumstances of the banks and local politics. France's large banks were in relatively good shape. Société Générale was fortunate that the so-called Kerviel scandal, involving €50 billion in unauthorised positions and losses of almost €5 billion, unwound in January 2008 rather than 6 months later at the height of the crisis. Société Générale managed to recapitalise and avoid a takeover, which might have ended as badly as the other shotgun weddings of the period. In addition, the French bank, which acted as a close partner of Goldman Sachs, was a particular beneficiary of the generous terms of the AIG bailout. But even if the other major French banks were robust, no one was exempt from the loss of confidence in the fall of 2008. On October 16th, an emergency recapitalisation and refinancing programme was ramrodded through the French Parliament. The urgency was commonplace. What was different in France was the response of the private sector. All of the major banks, led by BNP Paribas, agreed to take capital from the Société de Prise de Participation de l'État, SPPE. A second tranche followed in January 2009. Again, all the banks took the capital. Even more unusual was the refinancing scheme headed by the Société de Financement de l'Économie Française, SFEF. This entity was legally entitled to issue state-guaranteed bonds on behalf of banks up to a total of €265 billion, but 66% of its shares were subscribed by the 6 major French banks. Even HSBC France signed on. It was an elegant construction. With the French state holding only a minority stake, the SFEF's liabilities were not counted toward the French public debt. At the same time, thanks to a special arrangement with the banking regulators, the SFEF was not required to meet Basel II capital rules, so the actual financial call on the banks was minimal. It was an efficient mechanism for restoring confidence made possible both by the relative lack of pressure on France's biggest banks and close cooperation within France's extraordinarily tight-knit elite. Though they work in very different ways, business and government are every bit as interconnected in Paris as they are in New York and Washington, D.C., enabling that rarest of things under conditions of market competition, an uncoerced agreement on collective action. For sheer scale, Only Germany's programme rivaled that in Britain. On October 17th, the legislation establishing the Sonderfondsfinanzmarktstabilisierung was bounced through the Bundestag. But as in Britain, any possibility of a general solution was spoiled by the power of the dominant player. With the regional Landesbanken ailing and Commerzbank struggling with the ill-advised takeover of Dresdner, Deutsche Bank saw the opportunity to put distance between itself and the rest. In an internal discussion, which was clearly intended to be leaked, CEO Josef Ackermann stigmatized the national bailout package. He would be ashamed, he let it be known, to see his bank requesting help from Berlin. As Barclays was to do in the UK, Deutsche preferred to rely on accounting tricks and investments from Gulf state sovereign wealth funds to see it through the crisis. It too would later face legal action over its makeshift crisis management, but in the United States, not in Germany. Meanwhile, Steinbrück was livid. Ackermann, he said, had paved the way for a two-class society in the banking sector, into those that don't need help and those that are at risk of relegation. This is dangerous because the markets respond to it. It was the same problem that at the same moment was preoccupying Washington. After the setback in Congress on September 29th, there was never any option but for the Treasury to make a second attempt to get the TARP legislation on the books. To get TARP passed, Paulson abandoned his demand for a blank check. The $700 billion in bailout funds were split into three tranches, the first of $250 billion, a second of $100 billion, and $350 billion conditional on presidential request and congressional approval. Support for the banks would be balanced by tax breaks for the middle class and support for homeowners. Section 109 of the Act specifically empowered the Treasury Secretary to facilitate loan modifications to prevent avoidable foreclosures. Rather than immunity for the Treasury Secretary, the law now provided for multiple overlapping layers of oversight. On October 3rd, TARP passed into law, carried by 74% of the Democratic votes in the House, but only 46% of the Republicans. But by the first week of October, with events in the US markets and in Europe moving at a rapid pace, it was clear that TARP, as originally conceived, would not work. The Treasury faced the sheer impracticality of making markets for hundreds of billions of dollars worth of dubious assets at a time of market terror. Either it overpaid and sacrificed the taxpayer interest, or it drove a hard bargain and risked ruining the banks it was trying to help. Meanwhile, the British had tipped the discussion in favour of recapitalisation. Rather than buying bad assets or guaranteeing more borrowing by the banks, government should inject share capital. Having obtained the funds from Congress for asset purchases, TARP would now be repurposed as a vehicle for injecting capital. At the same time, events in Ireland, Germany, and the UK had changed the conversation about deposit insurance. According to Paulson, it was the risk of a shift in funds from the United States to Europe that led him and Bernanke to converge on the FDIC and to demand that its head, Sheila Bair, should offer even more comprehensive guarantees. The new package was worked out between the Treasury, the Fed, and the FDIC over the weekend of October 11th and 12th, in the shadow of the G7, G20 meetings. It was presented to the stunned CEOs of America's nine largest banks on the afternoon of Monday, October 13th, just as the Europeans were rolling out their guarantees. It was a take-it-or-leave-it offer. In rations fixed by Tim Geithner as president of the New York Fed, all nine major banks would be required to take slices of government capital. The shares would be preferred shares. The guaranteed dividends that the federal government would require were low, but would escalate after 5 years to give the banks an incentive to repay early. In exchange for accepting the capital injection, the banks would receive an FDIC guarantee on all business checking accounts and a guarantee on any new debt issued by the summer of 2009, up to a total of 125% of the debt maturing by the end of that year. The two were linked. No FDIC guarantee without government capital injection. Characteristically, Ben Bernanke sought to calm the fraying nerves in the room by appealing to everyone to consider their common interests. They were all in it together. "I don't really understand why this needs to be confrontational," he said soothingly. The bankers stared at him in disbelief. The core of American financial capitalism was about to be partially nationalized. Beyond the general sense of shock, the reactions came down to business logic. For the weakest in the group, it was evidently a great deal, and Vikram Pandit of Citigroup said so. Given the state of his balance sheet, he couldn't afford to be fussy. As he blurted out, "This is cheap capital." Indeed it was. The yield on Citigroup bonds that day was 22%. Paulson was asking for 5%. A better-placed bank, like J.P. Morgan, could have got by without the TARP money, but Diamond understood the systemic logic and was among the first to sign, though he made his signature conditional on the rest of the group agreeing. It was California's Wells Fargo that forced the government side to show its hand. When Wells objected to bailing out New York banks, Paulson coolly pointed out that Wells Fargo was sitting opposite its regulator. If they did not take the capital on offer that afternoon, they would be notified the following morning that they were undercapitalized. They would find themselves locked out of capital markets. When they came back to Paulson for help, the terms would be less attractive than those available that afternoon. The CEOs were then dismissed to call their boards. Within a matter of hours, they had all agreed. Under the Capital Purchase Program facility, America's 9 largest banks took $125 billion in preferred stock from the government. By comparison with a less encompassing effort in Europe, America's recapitalization would come to look very impressive, and this judgment was reinforced by hindsight. America's banks recovered from the crisis more quickly and comprehensively than their European counterparts. The meeting of October 13, 2008, it seems, is when the great transatlantic divergence began. Advocates of strong executive branch prerogatives would later celebrate these actions as an essential assertion of sovereign authority. As it had done after 9/11, the American state had declared a state of exception, and it had risen to the occasion. But comforting as it may be to invoke sovereign power at moments of great uncertainty, this is a mystification of the events in September and October of 2008. The path from Lehman to TARP was less one of a sovereign state rising to a crisis than of a dysfunctional power struggle within the social and political network that tied Washington, D.C. to Wall Street and to the European financial system beyond. In September, political and commercial considerations had prevented a deal to save Lehman. It took a month of panic, political confusion, and unprecedented financial turmoil to reach the point in mid-October when the barons of Wall Street would listen, when Paulson thumped the table and declared that everyone must take the Treasury's money. Even then, the executive branch had the power that it appeared to do in large part because J.P. Morgan swung behind the Treasury proposal. If this was an act of sovereignty, whose sovereignty was it? The American states, or that of the New Wall Street, the network personified by figures like Paulson and Geithner, who tied the Treasury and the Fed to America's globalized financial sector? The Treasury's act of power would have been more impressive if the injection of capital had been on onerous terms, but the opposite was the case. Vikram Pandit was right. The capital the Treasury was forcing on the banks was cheap in every respect. As Philip Swagel, Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury and a key architect of Paulson's bailout, has described it, to ensure that the capital injection was widely and rapidly accepted, the terms had to be attractive, not punitive. This had to be the opposite of The Sopranos or The Godfather, not an attempt to intimidate banks, but instead a deal so attractive that banks would be unwise to refuse it. The Treasury was far from being a difficult shareholder. Designating itself a reluctant shareholder, the U.S. government abstained from claiming any voting rights. Whereas in the UK and Germany, the nationalisation of Lloyd's HBOS, RBS, Hypo and Commerzbank was akin to bankruptcy restructuring and led to wholesale changes in management, America's more comprehensive approach was necessarily light touch. If robust J.P. Morgan was to participate in the scheme alongside ailing Citigroup, the terms could not be too onerous. The participants in TARP were allowed to go on paying dividends. The dividend to be paid on the capital provided from TARP was no more than 5%, half of what Goldman Sachs paid to Warren Buffett when he rescued them. The Treasury's aim was to persuade all banks to participate en masse so as to ensure that state support was not taken as a signal of weakness that would attract the attention of short sellers. As Steinbrück had spelled out in his furious reaction to Deutsche Bank, at a moment of crisis, defense of the system involved both treating everyone as though they were healthy and the healthier banks being willing to play along. They had to recognize that in the event of a truly comprehensive crisis, their cherished margin of superiority would not save them from disaster. The result of the Treasury's sovereign intervention was to extend a huge subsidy to the banks, increasing the value of their businesses by perhaps as much as $131 billion. The biggest beneficiaries were the fragile investment banks and the sprawling colossus of Citigroup. Citigroup received $25 billion from the Treasury in exchange for securities valued at $15.5 billion and soon to be worth much less. In contrast, Wells Fargo, widely regarded as one of the banking industry's stronger players, gave approximately $23.2 billion worth of securities for its $25 billion in government capital. J.P. Morgan did not need the money, and by agreeing to go along with the government's efforts to stop the run, Diamond passed up the opportunity to predate any more of his weaker competitors. For critics of the bailout, like Sheila Baer of the FDIC, it seemed that the entire process was a smokescreen put up to hide a bailout of Citigroup. The Clinton-era network was still at work. Citi was not just too big to fail, it was too well connected. Whatever one thinks of this interpretation, it is undeniable that as soon as the extreme panic of early October had passed, the pretense of equal treatment was dropped. The October stabilization was not enough for Citigroup. In November, it disclosed huge losses and announced 52,000 layoffs. By Friday, November 21, 2008, Citi's market valuation was $20.5 billion, down from $250 billion in 2006. As fear spread, the death knell sounded. Citi was losing access to repo markets. The end, it seemed, was nigh. Given Citi's immense size and entanglement in global markets, the consequences did not bear contemplating. In an urgent series of negotiations, culminating with Citi Weekend on November 22nd and 23rd, another deal was patched together. A second capital injection of $20 billion reinforced Citi's balance sheet, while a so-called loss protection plan protected it against losses on $306 billion in toxic assets. In exchange, the government received $7 billion in preferred shares, paying 8%. Bank of America was struggling too, and that put Merrill Lynch in jeopardy. As the takeover proceeded, the full scale of Merrill's mortgage losses was becoming apparent, and CEO Ken Lewis and his team at Bank of America were desperate to pull out of the deal that had saved the investment bank on September 14th. No one wanted to go back to Lehman Weekend. Under heavy pressure from Paulson and Bernanke, Lewis pressed on with the deal, withholding crucial information from Bank of America's shareholders, but taking another $20 billion in government capital and a loss protection arrangement on $118 billion of Merrill's troubled assets. The financial crisis was not yet contained, but at least in political terms, Wall Street was reassured. On November 4th, Barack Obama won the presidency, and the Democrats consolidated their grip on both the House and the Senate. American progressives celebrated a historic victory. Obama appeared as an almost messianic figure, and he occupied not just the White House. He had the congressional majority necessary to actually change America. And in a remarkable historical twist, the election of the first African-American president on the Democratic Party ticket was good news for Wall Street, too. It was Obama and the Democrats who had provided the Bush administration with the political backing they needed for the extraordinary crisis-fighting measures of 2008, and they clearly intended to continue that line. On November 23rd, the same day that the Treasury announced the latest round of support for Citi, Obama's team made public their nomination for Treasury Secretary. The rumor mill had been churning for weeks, perhaps not surprisingly given his long-standing connections to Obama. Rubin was on the short list, as was Larry Summers, his co-architect of Clinton-era deregulation. Paul Volcker, Greenspan's predecessor as Fed chair, godfather of disinflation in the Carter-Reagan era, was an Obama favorite. But he was too old. The others were too politically toxic. The man picked for the Treasury was none other than the hard-driving head of the New York Fed, Tim Geithner, a protege of Summers and Rubin. Summers was made head of the National Economic Council while he waited to replace Bernanke as Fed chair. Rubin would serve as an eminence grise behind the scenes, a Harry Hopkins role, Rubin liked to call it, while another of his protégés and partners in the Hamilton Project, Peter Orszag, would take the role as director of the budget. The keeper of the lists in the transition team was Michael Froman, Rubin's former chief of staff at the Treasury. Froman continued to draw a salary as Citigroup's head of emerging markets strategy while he moonlighted for the Obama campaign. In 2009, he joined the Obama administration as deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for international economic affairs. The only figure on the Obama economics team who did not belong to the Clinton-era old boys networks was Christina Roma, a new Keynesian economist from Berkeley and noted expert on the history of the Great Depression, who was appointed to be chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. The market liked the news. As one investment advisor noted, Geithner assures a smooth transition between the Bush administration and that of Obama, because he's already co-managing what's happening now. Indeed, even to talk in terms of a transition from the Bush administration to Obama is to exaggerate the break. Well before November 4th, the baton had already passed. The political party that had demonstrated its willingness to mobilize the full resources of the U.S. government to fight the financial crisis was the Democratic Party. The Republicans weren't so much a partner in managing the crisis as a symptom of it. In the course of the crisis, the GOP had shown itself to be less a party of government than a political vehicle through which conservative white Americans expressed their alarm at the earthquakes shaking their world. Chapter 8. The Big Thing. Global Liquidity. In retrospect, it can seem as though it was the decisions taken in the first weeks of October 2008 that decided the future course of events. The United States moved concertedly toward recapitalizing its banks. In Europe, proposals for a common approach were vetoed by Berlin. From there, the crisis unfolded as a series of national struggles that after 2010 became once again entwined in the form of the Eurozone crisis. In the end, Europe could not escape a common solution, but it would take years of economic uncertainty and distress before it arrived at that point. As the Eurozone crisis would reveal, the national approach insisted on by Berlin was fundamentally unfit for purpose. But by focusing attention on the European dimension of interdependence, that judgment, in fact, understates the case. The banks and the borrowers of Europe were indeed interdependent. But even more basic, and far more pressing in the fall of 2008, was their dependence on the United States. The closure of interbank and wholesale funding markets created huge pressures in the dollar funding markets all over the world. And it was in Europe that the pressure was most acute. This was a shortfall that even the strongest European states were powerless to address. That it did not result in a spectacular transatlantic crisis was decided not in Europe, but in the United States, where the Fed, acting in the enlightened self-interest of the U.S. financial system, acknowledged the compelling force of financial interconnectedness and acted on it. At a moment when Paulson and the Treasury were struggling with Congress to mobilize political support for a backstop for the American financial system, the Fed, without public consultation of any kind, made itself into a lender of last resort for the world. When the music in the private money markets stopped, the Fed took up the tune, providing a stopgap of liquidity that, all told, ran into trillions of dollars and was tailored to the needs of banks in the United States, Europe, and Asia. It was historically unprecedented, spectacular in scale, and almost entirely unheralded. It transformed what we imagine to be the relationship between financial systems and national currencies. The wholesale funding stop had hit the European banks already in August 2007. It was no coincidence, therefore, that it was the ECB that led the way in providing 95 billion euros in liquidity to overnight interbank markets on August 9th. Trichet was not the central banker to take such dramatic action without due cause. By the autumn of 2008, both the ECB and the Bank of England were pumping liquidity on a huge scale. This did not involve parliamentary votes or unusual long-term capital investments. These were not bailouts, but money market transactions of the type that central banks routinely conduct to tighten and ease financial conditions, but now on a scale never seen before. As they lent cash or cash equivalents against collateral, good and bad, the balance sheets of all the major central banks began to expand. Potentially, at least, this could be done without limit, within a closed national economy or a large currency zone like that of the euro or the dollar. But what such operations could not conjure up was liquidity in foreign currencies. The Bank of England supplied sterling, the ECB euros. This domestic currency constraint was a crucial limit on the power of central bank operations, and particularly so in 2008, because what the European banks desperately needed were dollars. It was into this breach that the Fed stepped with a program of liquidity provision that matched the global reach of the offshore dollar banking system. Starting from a conventional, trade-based view of international economics, it is not easy to see how a shortage of dollars could have been so threatening to Europe. In September 2008, the Eurozone as a whole was running a trade surplus with the United States. Germany in particular was a champion exporter. Surely if European banks needed dollars, they could buy or borrow them from global exporters like Audi, VW, and Mercedes-Benz. But this is where the disparity between the trade-based view of the economy and global financialization becomes starkly evident. In 2007, Germany's exporters earned a trade surplus with the United States of roughly $5 billion per month. According to calculations by economists at the Bank of International Settlements, what the European banks needed was not $5 billion or even $10 billion. Prior to the crisis, they had funded their dollar operations with around $1 trillion in commitments from U.S. money market funds. On top of that, they had borrowed $432 billion in the interbank market, $315 billion on the foreign exchange swap markets, and $386 billion in short-term funding from those monetary authorities that were managing dollar cash pools. In total, this added to more than $2 trillion. The precise figure depended on how much of Europe's gigantic bank balance sheet needed to be refinanced and how quickly. What the 2008 crisis exposed was a dangerous imbalance in the business model of the European banks. As the American money markets shut down, all the European banks were scrambling for dollar funding. They tried to borrow from one another, which led to a painful surge in short-term funding costs as measured by the so-called LIBOR-OIS spread. At the same time, the market for currency swaps was becoming dangerously congested, with Europeans bidding for dollar credits and ever fewer counterparties willing to take the other side of the trade. The cross-currency basis swap spread, which measures the interest rate spread that European banks were willing to pay to transfer euro or sterling funding into dollars, became strongly negative, indicating that it was extremely difficult to access dollar funding directly. When markets are functioning normally, this premium should be close to zero. In September 2008, it exceeded 200 basis points. When the FOMC met on September 16th, the day after Lehman's bankruptcy, with AIG teetering on the brink, its first item of business was the funding difficulties not of American, but of European banks. As Bill Dudley of the New York Fed put it, the big thing, where there has probably been the most severe stress in the market, is in dollar liquidity for foreign banks. Where could more dollar funding come from? One might think of central banks as a possible source of foreign exchange, but the dollar reserves of the European central banks were, by themselves, nowhere near large enough to meet the funding needs of the banks. As the crisis worsened in the autumn of 2008, and the City of London convulsed, the Bank of England had as little as $10 billion on hand. Throughout July, in the dollar auctions held regularly by the ECB, the bids exceeded the allotted sums by a factor of four. Little wonder that as the crisis deepened, the dollar was not falling in value, as standard macroeconomic models had predicted, but rising. Lesser countries in this kind of predicament would be directed to the IMF. And in the fall of 2008, in close dialogue with the US Treasury and the Fed, the fund was scrambling to devise a new genre of short-term liquidity facility to offer support for countries under acute funding pressure, which did not require a full IMF adjustment program. But for the ECB or the Bank of England to have resorted to the IMF would in 2008 have been a disaster of historic proportions. In any case, the fund was still defined by the basic rationale of the 1944 moment in which it was born, and had the proportions to match. The IMF financed trade deficits and handled public debt crises. It was not in the business of filling gigantic private sector funding gaps. Its programs were denominated in tens of billions of dollars. It was not conceived for an age of trillion-dollar transnational banking. In the autumn of 2008, the stark truth could no longer be escaped. As Tim Geithner of the New York Fed told the FOMC, the Europeans ran a banking system that was allowed to get very, very big relative to GDP, with huge currency mismatches and with no plans to meet the liquidity needs of their banks in dollars in the event that we face a storm like this. As Bernanke remarked with typical understatement, the dollar funding needs of Europe's banking system were a novel aspect of the current situation. It was a novel aspect with potentially drastic implications for the United States. If the Fed did not act, what threatened was a transatlantic balance sheet avalanche, with the Europeans running down their lending in the United States and selling off their dollar portfolios in a dangerous fire sale. It was to hold those portfolios of dollar-denominated assets in place that from the end of 2007 the Fed began to provide dollar liquidity in unprecedented abundance, not only to the American, but to the entire global financial system, and above all, to Europe. In 2008, that flow of dollars grew to such proportions that it rendered any effort to write a separate history of the American and European crises anachronistic, and profoundly misleading. The Fed labelled its liquidity facilities in a bamboozling array of acronyms. Among insiders, the programs were known collectively as the Hobbits. But when broken down by function, they mapped directly onto each of the key elements of the shadow banking system: the asset-backed commercial paper market, repo lending, the market for the mortgage-backed securities, currency swaps. As Fed economists observed, this was no longer conventional monetary policy in which the Fed manipulated interest rates to affect market behavior. Instead, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet expansion was an emergency replacement of lost private sector balance sheet capacity by the public sector. The Fed was inserting itself into the very mechanisms of the market-based banking model. The relationship between the state, as represented by the central bank, and the financial markets was nakedly revealed. The Fed was not just any branch of government. It was the banker's bank. And as the crisis intensified, the money market reorganized itself accordingly, taking on the shape of spokes, with the Fed as the hub. The scale of the Fed's liquidity actions was so large and varied that it poses problems of accounting. How should one measure the Fed's huge programs? As a stock at the point of maximum exposure? As a rate of flow over a given period during the crisis? Or should one simply compile the sum total of all lending from the beginning to the end of the crisis? The first measure will tend to minimize the image of intervention. The last measure will yield the largest figure. Each measure has its uses. Thanks to records extracted from the Fed by legal action, we can compile all three numbers. The point where distressed banks normally accessed central bank assistance was the discount window. At the discount window, the central bank bought and sold securities for cash. As a classic sign of stress, it was generally reserved for banks in dire need of emergency liquidity. The list of the largest customers at the discount window in 2008 included all the most prominent American casualties of the crisis: AIG, Lehman, Countrywide, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup. If anything, the stigma of using the discount window was less severe for non-American banks. So alongside the American strugglers, the Fed's accounts also prominently featured two of the European basket cases: Franco-Belgian bank Dexia, and the ill-fated Irish branch of Hypo Real Estate, DEPFA. As the ABCP market shut down in the autumn of 2007, the Fed realized that it needed to add new facilities. The first was the Term Auction Facility, TAF, which provided banks with access to short-term funds they could no longer acquire on the ABCP markets. Avoiding stigma was a key concern. A wide range of collateral, including ABS and CDO, were accepted, and the more banks participated, the more popular TAF became. Between December 2007 and March 2010, TAF expanded on a gigantic scale. The maximum outstanding balance in the spring of 2009 was almost $500 billion. If TAF loans of varying duration are converted to a common 28-day basis, the total sum loaned came to a staggering $6.18 trillion in 28-day loans. Hundreds of smaller American banks took advantage of TAF, but the biggest beneficiaries were the giant American and European banks, with Bank of America, Barclays, Wells Fargo, and the Bank of Scotland heading the list. Among the large borrowers, the foreign share was well over 50%. Following the Bear Stearns crisis, it was not just ABCP, but the collateralized repo markets that shut down. In the summer of 2008, the Fed, therefore, stepped into the breach, setting itself up as a repo dealer of last resort, offering 28-day repo against prime collateral, single-tranche open market operations, or STOMO. A total of $855 billion were lent by December 2008, of which over 70% was taken by foreign banks, with five European banks dominating the entire program. Just one bank, the Swiss giant Credit Suisse, was the recipient of 30% of the liquidity the Fed provided. Because the collateral that was preferred by tri-party repo markets was treasuries, in the spring of 2008, the Fed instituted another program, the Term Securities Lending Facility, under which it lent out top-rated U.S. treasuries on 28-day terms in exchange for a variety of mortgage-backed securities, including private label. In total, through this mechanism, $2 trillion in superior collateral was flushed into the system, with the program reaching its peak in the wake of Lehman in September and October 2008. Of the collateral provided by the Term Securities Lending Facility, 51% was lent to non-American banks, with RBS,